Okay, our last lecture this afternoon is from Dr. Michael Liske. Michael is a pediatric cardiologist in Knoxville, Tennessee, and he's been actively involved in the development of the heart program at Tenwick Hospital, along with Russ White. Michael and his wife Angela, who is also a physician, have four children, and he is going to be speaking to us today about practical echocardiography for missionary doctors.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure being here today, a great honor as well. First of all, I want to make a comment about who I am and who I'm not and who you are. First of all, you are, many in this room, are the long-term missionaries that are there all the time, and you're my heroes. Your dedication, your expertise is laudable. Your knowledge base, I think, is phenomenal when I see you folks working over there, just how broad and how much you know, and that's experienced by this talks I heard today. I will say I'm not one of you, and therefore my objectives are much more limited. And I hope that you will learn to obtain clear images in the limited 2D protocol, learn to recognize echocardiographic features of common chronic rheumatic lesions, and we'll briefly discuss the echocardiographic features of the revised Jones criteria, which just came out in February this year, and then become knowledgeable about equipment, personnel, and support options. So basically, at the end of this talk, you will have learned very little from me, but you will be able to do some cardiology, and that's especially if you listen very closely to Dr. Crognoli. So this is Ian. This is the little boy that Jenny Roberts mentioned last night, and he is 3 hours post-operative in this little video here. He just had his aortic valve replaced for chronic severe rheumatic heart disease, and he speaks with a typical Kenyan English accent, which is kind of like Boston. So when he says car, it sounds like ka. When he says doctor, it sounds like docta. But he's going to expound a little bit on his theology and also the dreams of his life. So please, Dr. Cheatham. So 3 hours out of the operating room, and I guess it's interesting also how, what benzodiazepines and opioids can do to release a child's expression. So that's why I go to Kenya every year. All right, so our first objective, how to obtain a clear image. There's four steps. First is put your patient in the correct position. Second is put the probe in the correct position. I'm sorry, I need to look at my slides. Select your proper transducer. Then put your proper transducer in the correct position, and then adjust your machine. And that's really all there's to it. If you fail to follow these steps, however, it will lead to all kinds of strife and problems. So, to position the patient, today we are only going to talk about the parasternal, so that's this area right here, parasternal and the apical views. And for both of those, if the patient's heart is in the left chest, you'll roll them to the left lateral decubitus position. Now, the question comes up, should I scan with my right hand or my left hand? Here, the sonographer is scanning with their left hand. I prefer my right one because it's stronger and I get a little better mobility with it. But again, that's your own choice. So selecting the proper transducer. In general, a low-frequency transducer will penetrate much better. and a high-frequency transducer will give you much better resolution. So think about the whale or the mouse. The whale has the real low sound to it, and that sound can transmit for miles, whereas the squeaky mouse, very short transmission. Or the sunset at nighttime, the sun's going down, you just see the red light because it's low frequency. It can transmit much better. So again, in the high-frequency transducers, we'll use those in kids, neonates, or in very superficial structures in adults. Low frequency for deeper and for most adult imaging. So what's the right place to place your transducer? And the answer is it depends. It's the place where you get the best image. There's not one absolute place. You should move that transducer around until you get the image that you want. Also, pushing hard will allow much better imaging as well. We'll practice that tomorrow in the hands-on section for those who come by. So here then is the parasternal long axis view. Again, the transducer is placed to the left of the sternum, and there's an indicator mark on the transducer that should be pointing towards the right shoulder. And again, at a variable intercostal space, and move that probe until you get the image that you want. So here now is our two representations of the structures we're looking at. And please memorize these. You're going to need these for the quiz later on in the talk. All right, so the long axis pertains to the long axis of the left ventricle. So you see the left atrium flow goes through the mitral valve to the left ventricle. And then in systole, it's ejected out the left ventricular outflow tract across the aortic valve. You'll see the ventricular septum there. And the right ventricular outflow tract is seen in partial cross-section above it. All right. Now, this is just a reminder of some of the cardiac relationships. And note how the two outflow tracts make a cross. All right. So the left ventricular outflow tract comes this direction. Right ventricular comes this direction. All right. And notice also how the pulmonary valve, which we think of as a right heart structure, and it is, really is positioned in space to the left of the aortic valve. And you can see that in that finely modified diagram there. All right. So parasternal short axis, again, the probe is in the same place, but you'll rotate it 90 degrees clockwise so that the indicator, which you can see in that picture now, is going towards the left shoulder now. Again, variable intercostal space, press hard, and move that probe for the perfect image. Now, this is a slide that I took from my talk entitled The Echocardiographic Assessment of Large Hairy Rodents. And I bring it up for 2 points. Again, left shoulder. And the second point is, in my practice, I've never had to shave a patient to get a good image. I don't know how that is with the adult cardiologist, but for me, I don't have to do that. So this is a busy slide here. And we think of the parasternal short axis. It's actually a series of parallel planes. And you can start up at the aortic valve, then you move down to the cross-section of the mitral valve, and then to the left ventricle at the papillary muscle, and then further down towards the apex. We're going to concentrate on that third image there, where you can see the left ventricle, you see the two papillary muscles, the intraventricular septum, and the right ventricle. All right, we're going to keep this very simple in learning echocardiography. Now, from that plane, if you drop a pick or a line down right between those papillary muscles, and you can develop then a graph of time versus spatial dimensions. And this is called M-mode echocardiography. And with this, then, you can measure the ventricular dimensions in diastole when they're larger and the ventricular dimensions in systole when they're smaller. And you can perform a very simple calculation called a shortening fraction, which we use in pediatrics all the time. Adults folks use it a little bit less, but this is correlated fairly well with ejection fraction as long as that left ventricle remains round and systole, which for our patients it typically does. And these numbers are in your handout as well, the correlation between the shortening fraction and the ejection fraction. So we'll move now to the apical four chamber view. So here you'll have to slide your probe down towards the left and a bit more inferiorly. A nice way to find it is if you can palpate the point of maximum impulse and put your probe right on the PMI. That typically will give you a beautiful image. Notice the structures in the diagram again. You need to memorize these for our quiz. Left atrium, left ventricle, the mitral valve between them. And then on the other side of the heart, the right atrium, the right ventricle, and the tricuspid valve. Typically, with a true four-chamber view, you will not see the aortic valve in contrast to what these images are showing. Now, we in pediatric like to put the image in its proper location on the right-hand side with the apex down and the atria on the top. But we do need to work an awful lot with the adult cardiologists, so typically when we're in Tenwick, we have all of our images with the apex up. So next stop, then, is proper knobology, or how do you adjust your machine so you get good images that are pleasing to the eye and will give you the information you need. And again, I do want to say that failure to follow all of these steps in order will lead to inaccurate diagnoses, poor patient care, your personal frustration, and potentially international despair, which I will get on more later. Image knobology. This is a screen of a full-purpose echo machine, and there's a typical QWERTY keyboard on the top, and then there's about a billion other knobs, and do you really need to know all those? And the answer is no. This is the basics. Number one, the on button. If that's not utilized, you're sunk to begin with. Next is the depth button, which you'll use to adjust the size of the screen. You want that image to fill the whole screen. You don't want it just at the very, very top of the screen. Next is the frequency selection button. So remember, we talked about different frequency probes. Each probe also has its own set of frequencies as well, and you want to adjust that for further refinement if you want more depth or more penetration. Next is the gain button. Not too bright, not too dark, just right. And again, that's a matter of personal appearance as well. And then finally, you'll need to save your images in some form, either a frozen frame or a moving image. And then for you overachievers, there's another button I think is really helpful as well. On some machines, it's called compression. On others, it's called dynamic range. And I don't know if you remember the old TVs where you had buttons you could adjust. That's the equivalent of the contrast. So if everything looks too light, you can adjust the contrast to make some structures look darker and vice versa. So again, you don't need to know all the buttons, but for good 2D imaging, these are the main ones to focus on. Now, once you've done that, you are not a fully qualified sonographer. And there are other views to be considered to learn on your own: subcostal, suprasternal, parasternal, other modalities, color and spectral Doppler, other ways of doing quantification as well. And here are some resources for you. They are all free. The first one, there's an excellent app by Epocrates. It's by Solomon. In your handout again, just download this. You do need Wi-Fi to run it, and they have absolutely gorgeous images of normal planes, parasternal long axis, short axis, subcostal, suprasternal. They have all kinds of normals. They got examples of rheumatic heart disease. They have some congenital defects in them as well. I can't support it enough. There's also 123sonography.com. This is a moneymaker, but they give the first four lessons for free. And then the next two are echocardiography books. And you can download this first one in its entirety. This is an adult echocardiogram book. It doesn't have a great how-to information in it, but the chapter detailing various valvar disease images is very good. The second one is a pediatrics book. You can only download part of it, but the part that you can download includes how to do a normal study. And then 4, 5, and 6, the Missionary Starter Echo Protocol, which we just talked about. Number 5 is the protocol that we use at Tenwick, what the sonographers go through to get images. And then the last one is our intake sheet. I think I forgot to give those to you, Mike, because they didn't make it in the handout. So if anyone needs those, come to me afterwards, and I will email them to you. I can even do that tonight if you like. All right, so that's the first objective. I have 21 minutes and 40 seconds left. We're next going to learn to recognize echocardiographic features of chronic rheumatic lesions. And I think this is the most fun part. So for those of you who are sleeping, you might want to come awake here. So first of all, as Dino said, rheumatic heart disease causes long-term valvar damage. And if significant, there will be secondary chamber alterations that you can see very quickly. All right, now mild disease, fortunately, doesn't cause symptoms typically. It still can be important in the sense that we're making a diagnosis of rheumatic heart disease, but it's the more severe ones that we're going to be treating, and you can diagnose those sometimes just by looking at the chambers, and we're going to do that. As Dr. Cronali said, rheumatic heart disease typically affects the mitral valve most commonly, then the aortic valve secondarily, and you will be able to diagnose the following by 2D imaging alone if the lesion is at least moderate severity: aortic stenosis and regurgitation, and mitral stenosis and regurgitation. Now, to review, it's important to discern the difference between dilation and hypertrophy. Sometimes people think it's a big heart, and you really need to be a little bit more specific of what that means. So the top is supposed to represent a normal heart with the LV and the thinner RV. Going down to the bottom right, we have what cardiac dilation does. So the intracavitary dimension becomes larger. That contrasts with pathologic hypertrophy, where the wall thickness becomes thicker. So in general, stenosis of the aortic valve causes ventricular hypertrophy. Stenosis of the mitral valve does cause atrial hypertrophy, although that's difficult to see. What you can see more often is dilation of the upstream chamber, namely the atria. Regurgitation at either valve will cause dilation, typically of structures on both sides of that valve. All right. Now here's a summary chart, and again, in your handout, that goes through these four lesions. So aortic stenosis, by 2D imaging alone, you can look at that valve, and it will look thick and abnormal, and it won't open well. And then again, you're going to have the left ventricular hypertrophy as a cardinal feature if you're at moderate severity or more. With congenital forms of aortic stenosis, you may see root dilation as well, so that's a little bit of a tricky one. Aortic regurgitation will cause possible annular dilation, leaflet prolapse, and coaptation failure. Very importantly, it will cause LV dilation, but not LA dilation unless the LV has started to fail. And then sometimes there will be aortic dilation as well. Mitral stenosis, Dino showed a beautiful picture of that. Small orifice, poor leaflet excursion, thickening, calcification. The primary cardinal finding there is left atrial dilation, and you might notice it thick as well, again, harder to see, but the LV will not be dilated nor hypertrophied. And then finally, with mitral regurgitation, you may see coaptation failure, you may see leaflet prolapse, and you should see both the left ventricle and the left atria as dilated. And with mixed lesions, it can be any of this. So that's the hard one. So that's it. You have all the information you need to diagnose moderate to severe rheumatic heart disease. And you've done it all with two-dimensional imaging. And I just want to hone the point here that two-dimensional imaging is so important. Some people think, I've got to get the color on, I've got to make the measurement of the gradients, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. Take a step back and really focus on the two-dimensional imaging first. Don't forget it. You can't become an effective echocardiographer until you're getting great two-dimensional images. All right. Audience participation. What is the dominant lesion? And to review, let's just review which valves are which. So this is a radiologic presentation. So the left hand of the screen are the right-sided chambers, so the right atrium on top, tricuspid valve below it, right ventricle below it. On the right side of the screen are the left heart features, the left atrium, then the mitral valve, and then the left ventricle. So who is bold enough to give us an answer? And again, I do give you a clue here. This is diastole. And I'll give you another clue here just as a freebie. What's going on in the right heart, just ignore that because they didn't image that side very well. Excellent. Mitral stenosis. So the key finding here, big left atrium, and look at that mitral valve. It's thick, and it's got a small little orifice. Instead of those valve leaflets opening broadly like this, it's domed, okay? Next one. So what's the dominant lesion? Again, a couple clues here. First of all, you have to decide if this is systole or diastole. I'm not going to tell you. Wait, what's the answer? Why is it systole? Oh, man! I forgot to block that out. Now, I will tell you, sometimes the internet is not very accurate, okay? So, which, say again? Exactly, the aortic valve is open. So this is systole, exactly. Dominant lesion then. So here's some clues. The normal left ventricular size is less than 2 times the diameter of the aortic valve. The normal left atrial size is less than 1.5 times the diameter of the aortic valve. In systole, what is the lesion? Dominant. Mitral regurgitation. Anyone else agree? Any dissenters? So this is correct. This is mitral regurgitation. Big LV, big LA. Again, you can't say much about the mobility of the mitral valve because we're in systole right now. It's not supposed to be open. Okay. All right. Systole or diastole, and what is the dominant lesion? And this is a trick question. Diastole, because the aortic valve is closed. Excellent. Any other thoughts from the elite audience members? Left atrium is dilated, making you think of mitral stenosis. All right. Why else might this be mitral stenosis? Yeah, the valve's not opening. Good. Now, what goes against this being purely mitral stenosis? Big LV, right. So what are our other possibilities then? Cardiomyopathy, possibly, yep. A little less likely with just pure mitral stenosis. Aortic regurgitation, right. And what else? Probably not aortic stenosis necessarily causing the dilation, but what else would cause that left ventricle to be big besides aortic regurgitation? Mitral regurgitation. So this could be mixed MR, MS, or MR, MS, AR, and all those could be possible in a patient with rheumatic heart disease. All right, what's the dominant lesion, and you don't get any clues? Why? Dilated aorta. What, okay. Again, you can get a dilated aorta with congenital aortic stenosis bicuspid valve, right? Okay, what else though? But you're correct. What else is abnormal about this image? No. You're telling me. You have all the information you need. Yeah, a little bit. That's what you do have a little probably false cord coming to the LV. I'm going to tell you it's not a thick LV, all right? But there's one other abnormality here besides the dilated aorta that goes along with this being aortic regurgitation. Yeah, there's a prolapsing aortic leaflet there. You see that, the one on the more closer to the bottom, more inferior leaflet there. All right. So here we go. What's the dominant lesion? And there are 2 clues here. Why? So you've got a thickened aortic valve, does not open fully. What else goes along with aortic stenosis? LVH, excellent. All right, is this a problem? And what is that? Thrombus. Why does it have a hole in the middle of it? The answer is I have no idea. But it has to be a thrombus because that's what the internet said. And any other abnormalities besides the thrombus? And why do you think he has a thrombus? And what else is going on? So this is just from one picture. You're going to make four diagnoses from this one picture here. Let's see if we can get them all. Thrombus is one. I'm going to say not an ASD. That could still be an intact atrial septum because there's something called echo droplet. It might be, but that's not diagnosis here. So we got the thrombus still one. Mitral, what's wrong with mitral valve? Thickened, so mitral stenosis is 2. Say again? Okay. Now what, here's another one too. You got dilated left atrium and a thrombus, mitral stenosis. What other diagnosis? And look at that. Look at the rhythm strip on the bottom. All right? Look at that. You all are cardiologists. One picture. And it's not even moving. Okay, so here's that same chart again, and I just want to highlight in bold their valve description. Keep your eye on that valve. What does that valve look like? I'm going to highlight LV hypertrophy for aortic stenosis, LV dilation for aortic regurgitation, LA dilation for mitral stenosis, and LV and LA dilation for mitral regurgitation. All right, briefly discuss the echocardiographic features of the revised Jones criteria. Again, just came out, and these came about largely in response to all the research that's going on, not in America, but in Africa and in that little gray dot of Australia that Dr. Crognelli pointed out. And they were finding that they were missing too many cases. And so the criteria have now been changed, with echocardiography now a very important feature in diagnosing acute rheumatic fever. This article, by the way, you can download it for free. You don't need a subscription. It's in your handout. All right, so here are the three major changes of the Jones criteria for 2015. These were last updated in 1992, so it's been a while. Number one, for recurrent acute rheumatic fever, all you need is three minor criteria in someone who's had rheumatic fever before. Three minor, that's it. That's almost nothing, and you can diagnose them with it again. Number two is subclinical carditis, which I'm going to spend a bit more about in just a moment. And the last one is that they are dividing populations up into two groups, low prevalence populations and higher prevalence populations. And those in the higher prevalence populations, they are allowing weaker criteria in order to make the diagnosis. Specifically, instead of requiring polyarthritis, now monoarthritis or polyarthralgias will make a major criteria. And then next, for the minor criteria, monoarthralgias satisfy, as do a fever of 38 instead of 38.5. And then the SED rate, I think, is 30 instead of 60. All right, so if you're living in Kenya, Sudan, Australia, and you're going to hopefully get diagnosed a little bit more readily with these new criteria. So let's talk about subclinical carditis, because that affects our talk today, which is echocardiography. And again, the definition then is a patient who has heart disease, but when you listen, you don't hear a pathologic murmur, and they don't have cardiac symptoms. All right, so this is subclinical carditis. Note that not any old echo findings of these valves will satisfy, and we're going to talk about that. And the 2D findings are all evident with the imaging planes you have learned. All right, so just knowing the parasternal long axis, short axis, and apical views, you'll be able to look adequately at these valves to make the diagnosis of subclinical carditis. So here are the 2D criteria, and again, many of them we've already talked about. Changes in the mitral and aortic valves. And these are in your handout. I'm not going to go through them in detail. However, in spite of all of my emphasis on 2D and my blustering about it, for mild valve disease, you do need color Doppler. All right? And here's an image on the left side of mild mitral regurgitation, which you may or may not hear. And then on the right side, you see the aortic valve with mild regurgitation as well. All right, there are unfortunately, the normal population often has just a tiny bit of aortic and mitral regurgitation. So we can't just use any color map anomaly and say that's good enough to meet these criteria. Rather, there are very specific ones. They have to be seen sometimes in more than two planes. The jet has to be so long, it has to go through the entire systole, etc. Again, these are in your handout. So why is diagnosing subclinical carditis as a manifestation of rheumatic fever so important? Again, Dr. Crognelli spent a ton of time on this, and I agree with him. Just a little bit more of a diagrammatic representation here, just so that it's all in our heads what this is all about. It starts with strep throat. Strep throat leads to rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever leads to chronic rheumatic heart disease. The number I came, Dino said 2%. I caught 3% of patients who have untreated strep throat, 3% of them will develop acute rheumatic fever. And of those, about 30 to 50% will develop rheumatic heart disease that can be chronic, but fortunately, with the first episode of acute rheumatic fever, the heart disease will be mild. However, in a patient who has had rheumatic fever in the past, if they get strep throat again and it's untreated, there's a 75% chance they'll get acute rheumatic fever, And of those, nearly 100% will then go on to develop chronic rheumatic heart disease. All right? So again, there's that window of opportunity, and that's why Dr. Crognoli is going out to the schools with the echo machine and his assistants, and they're doing echocardiograms on all the kids to see who might have had that first acute rheumatic disease and has very, very mild mitral or aortic regurgitation, and then they're putting them into a bicillin clinic to prevent recurrence. All right? Another good point, out in the bush, most kids in your mission clinics will not be coming into you because they have strep throat. Their families know that when kids get sore throats, if they wait 3 or 4 or 5 days, it'll go away. And that's with or without antibiotics. And most kids do fine, and they're not going to trek in from their farms to come see you. They got better things to do. You will, on occasion, see some with arthritis or chorea. But again, even all those kids don't necessarily come to the hospital, and that's why the screening clinics, again, are important. Screening clinics aren't great, by the way. There are lots and lots of studies have shown that compliance with monthly screening clinics can be pretty, pretty sketchy in some places, sometimes less than 25%. Again, it really depends on how it's set up. And my hope still is with these vaccines that are being developed. So there's a fellow out in Memphis, Jim Dale, who's really big into that, and he's pretty optimistic that we're going to find something. I got 4 minutes. Become knowledgeable about equipment, personnel, and support options. Equipment, portable units, in my opinion, are an absolute must. There's no sense in getting a huge machine and taking it overseas. It will break down. It's very expensive. And most importantly, when the portable unit breaks down, you've got people going back and forth to the States all the time. They can hand carry it back and get it fixed. Two models we've used, the GE Vivid Q and the Sonosite M Turbo. I'm not endorsing any. I know I'm not supposed to do that, I think. The Vivid Q, more expensive, better resolution, better storage. It can store about 500 studies or so. We can use it in peds, adults, neonates. The Sonosite, this thing is a workhorse. I don't think you can break this thing. It's very durable. It works very, very adequately in adults and some larger kids. Personnel, physician champion, there has to be someone at the missionary hospital that's going to be the cardiac person. They need to be able to scan, interpret, and treat these patients. And we started out with a surgical resident, one of the PACS surgeons. Her name is Dr. Odera, Agneta Odera. Probably one of the best physicians I've ever worked with. If I ever get sick in the United States, Angie, can you fly me to Kenya so she can take care of me? She has become a very facile echocardiographer, and she's a very, very smart gal. She is kind of moving on her career, and Dr. Crognoli has come along, family practice, and he's picking up for her. He's doing a great job as well, but you got to have someone at the hospital that's going to do this. There has to be a time set aside for them to spend time with these patients and learn their skills. Technicians recommend at least 2 technicians so that they can work with each other, learn from each other, cover a call with each other. They're going to need to do more than just scan, though. They're going to have to set up schedules, databases, archiving, all that kind of thing. Lots and lots and lots of training. Support for the cardiologists, and this is where you folks that are overseas, you get on the phone or get on your computer and you find all of your friends that are cardiologists back home and you get a schedule for them and you have them interpret your images. Ask for technical aid. How can I make my images better? Ask for management clues. What should I do with this patient? Getting the studies back to the States can sometimes be difficult. CDs are pretty much worthless. Google Drives work pretty good. I just found out last week that we've got another solution probably going to be working at Tenwick. This is where it comes to this international despair thing. If you can make good images, then I can interpret them and give you help. If the images are poor, it's very, very difficult to give advice. And in our last 1 minute and 18 seconds, these are your top 10 take-home points. Number one, follow the 4-step plan to obtain excellent images. Number 2, first learn the 3 two-dimensional planes, parasternal long axis, parasternal short axis, apical 4-chamber. Number 3, then expand your repertoire of skills with the resources provided. Number 4, learn the 2D features of common rheumatic lesions. Number 5, be knowledgeable
of the echocardiographic features of subclinical carditis in the 2015 Jones criteria. Number 6, develop a bicillin program. Number 7, use portable equipment. Number 8, develop your stateside support. Number 9, you can do it. Number 10, God be with you. And thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking to you today. And we have 31 seconds for questions. So scarlet fever supposedly is caused by a different strain than rheumatic fever. So scarlet fever tends to come more from skin lesions. The old thinking was, no, they're not related. There seems to be data, particularly from Australia, that there are rheumatogenic strains of impetigo, for example, that can cause rheumatic fever. So I would still think of scarlet fever and rheumatic fever as different things, but what might be overlapping now is that the organisms that cause rheumatic fever can actually colonize and infect the skin. Does that answer your question? That's what some of the Australian data. Dino, do you have any other thoughts about that? I know you've reviewed this all lately. Yeah, and you hear when you take histories on folks, my great grandmother died of scarlet fever because of her heart, and I think there is probably a misconception about what was causing what there. But there are skin strains of strep, group A strep, that apparently can cause rheumatic heart disease. Yes, ma'am.
We're gonna have to stop. I would encourage, because we could go on. I've got questions of my own. I could go on.
We're out of time.
Sorry. Okay. Tomorrow afternoon, we'll have 2.5 hours to pick Dr. Liske's brain and have him actually show us hands-on how to do exactly these views. So I would encourage you to come to the skill station tomorrow. Dr. Dick Furman and his brother Lowell founded World Medical Mission. I've asked Dick to come and close this in prayer.
Let us pray. Our Father, we come to you at this time thanking you for allowing each of us to be here. We thank you for letting us see your presence here. We just ask that you use each participant this weekend to speak your words to us, to touch our hearts, to see where you would have us go, what you would have us to do, and just open our eyes to understand how you use mission hospitals to spread your word. And we just pray especially, Lord, for these the post-residents, the young doctors that are on the field now and the ones that are here that are going to be going out, that you will guide each step of their way as they go. And, Lord, we do acknowledge you as our God, and we know that you control the future, and we just put our future in your hands and just lay this before you in Jesus' name. Amen.